great pleasure to have our very own Lucien Hardy as the colloquium. Lucien's been here since 2002. He likes to say he's one of the first non-founding members.
Actually, the first non-founding member.
The first non-founding member. Lucien's obviously in the field of quantum foundation, which is my field as well. And so if I had to characterize what was typical of Lucien's research, I would say it's always ahead of its time. So if there's some topic that becomes popular in quantum foundations, you'd be pretty sure that Lucien's not researching it. But he was there 10 years earlier thinking about it. And so characteristically, he's one of the first people to start thinking about how to take some of the operational frameworks that are popular in quantum foundations and apply them to general relativity. And that's what he's going to tell us about today.
Thank you. Okay, and of course, you can get more details in this course, which will start on Monday. Notice there's a slight break in the pattern. One of the lectures on a Friday. This talk is based on the paper that's referenced at the end there, which is on the archive. It's over 200 pages, and I don't think anyone has read it all the way through, even possibly myself. I wrote it all the way through. I'm just not sure I read it all the way through. So the objective here is to formulate general relativity in operational terms, so in terms of the sort of things we do and see, knob settings and outcomes on apparatuses. And this should be analogous to the operational circuit formulation of quantum theory. So in the circuit formulation, you put together boxes which have lights that can flash on them, and you try to calculate the probability for all those, the joint probability for all those lights flashing. If you can do this, then it opens up a possible operational route to formulating a theory of quantum gravity. What I'm going to provide in this talk is a possibilistic formulation of general relativity. In other words, we'll have certain situations described operationally and provide a calculus for determining whether those situations are possible or not. So possibilism is not terribly familiar to physicists as a way of thinking, although it is the sort of natural way of doing, of situating deterministic theories, such as GR, in a kind of operational circuit type framework. So here's one example of possibilistic thinking. You can take these Penrose type objects. So here's a Penrose triangle, but you could imagine a much more general set of objects where you take beams of wood and you join them at their corners. And each local join is legal, but in some cases, such as the example there, the whole object is impossible. You can imagine representing that sort of situation diagrammatically in a more abstract fashion, as I've done there. And you could ask whether it's possible to develop a possibilistic theory that tells you whether these objects are possible or not. If they're possible, you can give them the value 1, and if they're impossible, give them the value 0. Okay, so that's the sort of thing we're aiming for in the context of general relativity. But first of all, let's start with quantum theory. And so a curious fact about quantum theory that not everybody knows, some people are surprised when they learn this for the first time. Certainly, I was surprised when I learned this already quite deep into my career as a quantum foundations researcher. You can formulate quantum theory in a way that's linear in probabilities. You don't need to formulate it in terms of amplitudes, which kind of go as the square root of probabilities. So let me just make this seem reasonable to you. Consider a spin half particle, A, and it has a density matrix rho. Okay, here's the density matrix. Well, there's a linear relationship between this density matrix and this object here, which is just a list of some probabilities. And you can see that because, well, first of all, the spin up and spin down along the z direction, those probabilities appear on the diagonal. then you look, if you look at this off-diagonal number here, you can represent it as a linear sum with complex coefficients of these probabilities. This is spin up, the probability for spin up along the x direction, the probability for spin up along the y direction. Okay, and these ones as well. So in other words, if you have these four numbers, then you can reconstruct the density matrix. And furthermore, that reconstruction is linear. There's a linear relationship between these objects. So what that means is if you want to calculate the probability where you have some preparation rho, I'm calling it A here, associated with this, on preparation for this system, spin half system, and then you have a measurement, and you're interested in the probability of some outcome on this measurement. Well, in standard quantum theory, the way you calculate that is that it's given by the trace of some positive operator associated with the measurement times the density operator associated with the preparation. But we know that there's a linear relationship here, and the trace is also a linear operation. So we know that this expression must be linear in A, so it must be the dot product of something with A. Well, that B, this B here is associated with the measurement and the outcome. So we know that we can write down the probability for any outcome of any measurement in this linear form. And in fact, we can expand that in terms of its components, and we can even write it diagrammatically like this. So the components of this are just the z plus, z minus, x plus, and x minus. Those are the labels of here, of this here. You'll see what's nice here is that the diagram that tells you how to calculate this probability looks exactly like the diagram it's a probability for. Okay, you might think that's a coincidence, but actually you can do that for any of these this circuit type calculations, and I'll show you how that looks later. One thing to watch out for in my talks in general is the fonts. So over here we have MathsFF font, a sans serif font. And this corresponds to a diagram of something that's happening in the laboratory. And over here we have normal math font. And this corresponds to a mathematical calculation. Okay. But if you change the font, if you have a situation in the laboratory and you change the font, then you get the calculation for that same situation. So this leads to this idea of general probability theories. So you can situate quantum theory in a much more general framework where your objects in that framework are linear in probability. These things nowadays go by the name of GPTs. It's easier to consider modifications to quantum theory if you work in this kind of GPT framework. It's very difficult to modify quantum theory if you work in an amplitude framework, because you've already pretty much committed yourself to Hilbert space and linear evolution in that. But in this GPT framework, then you can much more easily consider modifications. And this framework is, for example, more general than the C-star algebraic framework. In a C-star algebraic framework, you have algebraic structure, and that algebraic structure carries with it certain assumptions that you don't put in to this framework. So this is a very general framework for looking at probabilistic theories, such as quantum theory. There's a long history of people looking at quantum theory from a sort of operational and structural point of view. So it's interesting to go back and see who invented the various concepts. So density matrices were invented in 1927 by von Neumann. Completely positive maps, this is the most general kind of evolution you have in quantum theory. It includes unitary evolution, but it also includes projections and more general evolution, were invented by Sudarshan in 61. What are called positive operator valued measures. This is the more general notion of measurement that you need to have in operational quantum theory, were invented in 67 by Yao and Piron. And then there's various early syntheses of all these things. There's a book by Davies in 1976, which puts these things together. There's also lots of ideas, early ideas, on trying to reconstruct quantum theory within various frameworks by imposing certain axioms or postulates. So you know, there's quantum logic, there's C-star algebra approach, there's operational approach, there's convex probability spaces. All these things have a sort of historical precursors down here. And then there's been a lot of work recently on this kind of operational and structural thinking. I've highlighted in blue anybody who is or has been at Perimeter Institute. I mean, as a, like a postdoc or faculty or whatever. So a few, so John Selby is a postdoc who's just arrived. Philip Goyle is visiting for 2 months. Philip Hearn has just left, is now in Vienna. Giulio Chirabella has just moved to Oxford. Matt Liefer is at Chapman University. So there's been a lot of work on reconstructing quantum theory and also on sort of structural and sort of reformulation thinking in recent years. Okay, so let's get started with some basic ideas. So the most basic idea in operational quantum theory is the idea of an operation. Well, first of all, you start with the idea of an apparatus. So an apparatus, if you go into the laboratory and they have their various pieces of apparatus that they stick together to do an experiment, an apparatus has various things on it. It'll have some knobs that you can vary to change the setting. Then it will have some outcomes. So for example, you may have different lights that can flash. And this could be the red light flashing. This could be green, blue, yellow, and so on. And then also you have inputs and outputs. The way I've drawn it here, you have two inputs and two outputs. But you could have, you know, three inputs and just and five outputs or whatever. The numbers don't have to match. Now, when you have an apparatus, you can do various things with it. Like you can kick it. You can drop it from a tall building. Or you can use it in the way that it was meant to be used by the people who built it. And if you do that, then you have this notion of an operation. So here is a sort of abstraction of an apparatus where you prescribe the use of it. So you imagine that into this aperture, you send particles of type A. So this could be electrons. You know, you might instead want to send small rocks into it. If you do that, the apparatus will break. It's best to use it in the way that it's meant to be used, and so on. Okay, and then also we have implicit in this notation is that there's some fixed setting, some given setting, and also that there's some given outcome that we're considering. If you want to consider a different outcome, then you have to change this symbol A in the middle. The arrows on here indicate time direction. Then what you can do is wire together a whole bunch of these apparatuses. So there's what you do there is you put the apertures next to each other. So then a system will pass from one to the next. The electron, for example, will pass from one to the next. So you get a circuit. These symbols, like I said, these indicate different types of system. So this could be an electron. This could be a photon, and so on. And here, what we have is an operational description where the composition is given. So that's the wiring, the way you put the experiment together. Also, we're given certain settings. So each of these pieces of apparatus has a setting given. And then also, we're given certain outcomes. Each of these apparatuses has a certain outcome specified. In a probabilistic theory, what we're interested in is calculating the joint probability that given that the settings are the ones that you fixed, and given that the wiring is the ones that you fixed, you want to calculate the joint probability that the outcomes you've specified happen on each of these boxes. So we could have here specified a red light. Here it could be the green light. Here it could be a red light. Here, purple light. Here, the yellow light. We want to know what the joint probability is that all those lights flash. And GPTs sort of give a way of doing that kind of thing. So in particular, I have developed what I've called the duotensor framework for probabilistic theories. And in that framework, you can do a calculation like this. So the probability for a circuit like this is given by a diagram that looks exactly the same, but where you've changed the font. And so each of the, this is a description of what's happening in the laboratory. And this is a mathematical calculation. This is a sort of Penrose style of notation for tensor calculations. But whenever you see a wire connecting two of these, so each of these circles corresponds to a tensor. And then when you see a wire connecting them, what you're doing is you're summing over over some index here. So the summation is indicated by the wires. So here we have what I call the composition principle. The calculation has the same compositional structure as the thing it is a calculation for. It seems to me that's a very nice feature for a physical theory. It'd be nice if we could formulate all physical theories in that fashion. I just wanted to show you the underbelly of the duotensor formulation. So I've sort of hidden all this structure. There's this sort of black and white dots, and they just correspond to the fact that these objects are slightly more complicated than being just tensors. They're, I call them duotensors, and they have two positions for each index on the left or the right of the tensor, if you like, indicated by a black or a white dot. I'm not going to go into any details on that during this talk. And also, you can use this duotensor framework to formulate quantum theory. And in the case where you're interested in quantum theory, you can go over to what I've called the operator tensor formulation of quantum theory. Each of these duotensors is linearly related to a certain operator, just like at the beginning of the talk when I showed you that list of probabilities was linearly related to a density matrix. Well, the same thing is true here. Each of the these duotensors is linearly related to an operator which has a certain tensorial structure given to it. One thing that's good about this way of formulating quantum theory is that you don't have to, in order to do the calculation, you don't have to think of the state evolving in time. So you could foliate this circuit and then do the calculation over these wires in the order of that foliation. But in actual fact, you're allowed to do the calculation where you contract over these wires in any order that you want. These wires, in this diagram, these wires correspond to taking the partial trace over an appropriate part of the Hilbert space. We can also think about possibilistic theories in this kind of circuit diagram. So in a possibilistic theory, what we're interested in is whether all the outcomes on each of these operations are jointly possible or not, given the settings that you have on these apparatuses, and also given the composition that we have. So you could think of that as being the G pos T approach. And this calculation should give you a value equal to 0 or 1. The calculations look just the same. You have these duotensor calculations. When we do this summation over the wires, we have to use what I've called the possibilistic summation convention. So we sum over the appropriate indices. And when we get 0 plus 0, we get 0. 0 plus 1 gives 1. And 1 plus 1 also gives 1. And the reason for that is that if something's possible, or it's possible, then it's possible. So use that. Okay. And 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus 1 plus 1 plus 0 plus 1 equals 1. Yeah, so just you have these very long sums of lots of zeros and ones.
Well, if something is not possible and then you ask something is possible, then it's possible. What does it mean?
Oh, so if you're considering lots of different ways in something which might be possible, and it's not possible in any of those ways, then it's not possible. If you're considering lots of different ways in which something is possible, and it's possibly more than one of those ways, one or more of the, one of those ways, then it is possible.
Oh, so it's like a logical law.
Yeah, it's just a logical law. Yeah. Okay. So so that's quantum theory. Let's come over to general relativity. So people have lots of different attitudes towards GR. So here's the sort of way I would understand it, this is the basics of GR. What you start off with is a prescription for turning special relativistic matter field equations into general relativistic matter field equations. And that prescription has, you do these things. You replace the Minkowski metric with this general metric, G mu nu. This bar indicates that you have some inertial coordinate system, globally inertial coordinate system. Replace derivatives with covariant derivatives, and then you replace all the remaining indices that are in the flat coordinates into these general coordinates. And that will give you a way of changing matter field equations into GR equations. The thing is, when you do that, you've introduced the 10 extra parameters here, these G mu nus. And so you need a 10, you've introduced 10 extra real variables. So you need 10 equations, 10 more equations than you had previously in order to be able to solve. There's actually a twist in the tail here, because if you take the covariant derivative of G mu nu, then it's identically equal to 0. So although you thought you had 10 equations, there's really only 6 equations. And the reason for that is that the thing you're getting is the solutions you get are invariant under general diffeomorphisms. So you need, in the last of these three parts, you need an interpretation. So you write down a solution as various tensor fields on a manifold. But the things that are real are quantities which are invariant under general diffeomorphisms. One of the things that you might say is missing from this way of thinking about GR is an operational identification. It doesn't tell you which of the actual things that you directly see. It tells you what's real. So actually, Beebles, that word may not be familiar to everyone in the audience. This was John Bell's word. It's the things that are able to be, so the things that are real in a theory, used usually in quantum foundations. But you can apply it equally well to general relativity. So the stuff that's real is stuff that's invariant under diffeomorphisms.
Question.
Yeah.
Is a Beebe different from Reynolds zone?
So usually in general relativity, people call what I've called here Beebles, they call those observables. The problem is that some of these things that are real are not directly observable. They may be indirectly observable. But the things that you directly observe may be some limited set of the Beebles. For example, if you have some event over here, then you have a distance between those two events. But you have no apparatus in place to measure that distance, then it's not something that's directly observable. But you can imagine putting in place an apparatus and then reading off the answer after the apparatus has done its work. So it seems that in GR, at least a sort of an intuitive understanding of what's happening, there would be certain quantities that aren't actually directly observable, but they are indirectly observable. So you have this dichotomy between observables, things that are directly observable, and things that are, you could call them hidden variables. So I had to change the word here from observables to Beebles, because I think it's the wrong word. And that means I can now talk about observables as being something different, the things that you actually directly see. But normally, in general relativity, you're not given that. You're not given a prescription as to what are the things that you directly see. So we're free to think about different possible choices for what it is that you directly observe. Well, I'm going to give. In a sense, you're free to sort of decide different, to take different routes here. I'm going to give a particular way of pursuing this in maybe a few slides' time. Yeah. So, but standard general relativity is, I would say, missing an identification of what the things are that are observable. So Einstein said, well, typically the things you see are particles in coincidence with one another, like a pointer, for example, in coincidence with a certain place on a scale, or these kinds of objects. So coincidences are the kinds you typically see. But that's not quite those ideas aren't quite suitable to general relativity because it's a field, it's a theory of fields. So we have to really give an identification, an operational identification in the context of the fields that occur in the theory. Okay, well, first of all, some motivation. The reason I'm doing this is because I want to open up an operational route to quantum gravity. Let's just discuss what the problem of quantum gravity is in the first place. And this is to find a theory that limits to general relativity and to quantum theory in appropriate cases. So suddenly, this new theory that we find, the theory of quantum gravity, has to have general relativity as a limit in those cases where general relativity has been empirically verified. And likewise for quantum theory. The new theory that we find could be expressed in very different mathematics. It could be as different from either general relativity or quantum theory as, for example, general relativity is from Newtonian mechanics. So we should be allow ourselves to consider very different sorts of physical theories, very different sorts of mathematical formulations. If we're going to try and find this more fundamental theory of quantum gravity, then it's worth looking at conservative and it's worth looking at the less fundamental theories, i.e. general relativity and quantum theory. And then we can look at the features that these have. And you can see they have conservative and radical features. So general relativity is conservative in the sense that it's deterministic, but it's radical in that it has dynamical causal structure. So the metric, which is what determines whether two events are, you know, space-like or time-like, what the causal structure is between them, is something you have to solve for. So it's dynamical. Quantum theory, on the other hand, is conservative in that it has a fixed background causal structure. In fact, the way quantum theory is normally formulated, the causal structure is really built in into the very way you define the objects. You have preparations, you have measurements and transformations. Normally, you evolve a state in time, so you have a state and you evolve it through a series of space-like hypersurfaces. So you're really using this causal structure that's there. Quantum theory is radical in that it's probabilistic. It's kind of inherently probabilistic. You can't write down quantum theory as it's normally understood without using probabilities. So it seems reasonable to expect that a theory of quantum gravity will take the radical route in each of these two cases. So it means that it should be a probabilistic theory with dynamical causal structure. Although when you think about it, it might be a bit more than that, because in quantum theory, any quantity that's subject to variation is also subject to superposition. So a particle can go through, if a particle can go through one slit or another, then you can have a superposition of the particle going through both slits. In some sense, in those cases, there's no matter of the fact as to whether the particle goes through the left slit or the right slit. It's sort of indefinite. And so we'd expect the same thing to be the case in quantum gravity. We'd expect there to be indefinite causal structure. So this raises a big problem. If we have indefinite causal structure, then it's going to be very difficult to get a theory based on time evolution, because imagine trying to foliate your space-time into space-like hypersurfaces. Well, each of those space-like hypersurfaces would be separated by time-like intervals and would have space-like intervals over small displacements on the surface. And those concepts rely on you having definite causal structure. So it won't work. And so it seems to me that what you need instead is a kind of compositional theory. So we don't really have the option of evolving a state in time, because you don't have the right kind of, we don't have definite causal structure. But we still want to be building up a picture of the big from a picture of the small. So what we can do instead is imagine composing lots of small regions to make bigger regions. This is a way of doing physics where you build up a picture of something bigger from something smaller. So I define here what I call, so motivated by this, I define what I call the principle of general compositionality. The laws of physics should be written in such a way that they apply to any compositional description of any object, and in terms of calculations having the same compositional structure as this description. So you remember I showed you how you had this composition principle where the calculation for a circuit was in terms of a picture having exactly the same compositional structure. I'm putting that in here as well. And you can compare this principle with the principle of general covariance. So the laws of physics should be written in such a way that they apply to any coordinate system and so that they take the same form in any coordinate system. Indefinite causal structure, you can use that to motivate the principle of general compositionality, just as the lack of a global inertial coordinate system leads to the principle of general covariance. So this is all fine, except that we need a space in which we're going to compose these objects together. The obvious space in which we would do that would be the manifold. But it turns out that doesn't work for reasons I'll discuss in a bit. So instead, I'm going to define an operational space. And this will answer the question as to what is the operational identification I'm proposing here. I'm going to use the circuit kind of picture. So we'll imagine, you know, this is, if you expand this out, it sort of looks like a circuit. You know, you have, wherever the two surfaces touch, you have wires. Is that right? We need a diffeomorphism invariant way to define the operations that we associate with this. And it has to have settings, outcomes, and also the wires. And we can't require that we have definite causal structure in setting this up. OK. Yep.
What determines those links? There is a temporality about it.
There isn't going to be, because, well, maybe I have to show you how it works, and then you can see that there isn't, yeah. That's an essential point, which hopefully I will get. Okay, so we can, in general relativity, you know, you have a manifold, the manifold, and at each point on the manifold, you have some set of tensor fields. So the tensor fields are the metric, and then also various matter fields. And if you have, if you find a solution, what you're doing is you're specifying these fields each point on the manifold. Okay. So write that down as psi tilde. The tilde is important. I write that down as psi tilde. The reason I choose the letter psi is because I come from a background in quantum foundations, I was feeling a little bit lost in general relativity, so I took over a letter that was very familiar to me and repurposed it. One thing you can do is if you have a solution, or you specified it on some manifold, you can apply a diffeomorphism. That's a smooth transformation. It takes the point P to some new point Q. And if you apply a diffeomorphism to the solution I just showed you, this one, then what you do is you map it to this. So P goes to Q. These fields are now located at Q, and they take some transform values under this diffeomorphism. And then the manifold itself also gets mapped under this diffeomorphism. Now, the problem here is that imagine if you try to talk about the properties in some region of the manifold. You say, well, what's happening over here? To answer that, you could look and see what values the fields take. The only problem is that you can act on this with a diffeomorphism, which will take these fields somewhere else. from a different region and replace them with fields from over here. And yet, these two situations are physically equivalent. What that means is you can't actually talk about reality in a certain region of the manifold. I wrote it there as the manifold is non-stick, as far as reality is concerned, perfectly non-stick. So there's no sense in talking about what's going on in a certain region of the manifold. We can't set up our operational compositional theory on the manifold. It's simply the wrong space. So instead, the space I'm going to use is this operational space that I'm going to define shortly. OK, here, in fact. So finally, here's the idea. Operational space is going to be defined like this. So imagine an ordered set of scalars here, S1, S2, up to SK. These scalars are simply calculated from the tensors you have available to you, so the metric and the matter field. Tensors at any point p, you can calculate various scalars just by forming objects which have no indices left over. So there's lots of different ways you can do that. And because this is meant to be an operational approach, it's sufficient just to define. Well, how can I put this? So operationalism isn't a way of understanding the world in fundamental terms. You know, in a laboratory, you have apparatuses that are built in certain ways, and the certain properties of those apparatuses that correspond to what you see. So it's not as if there's some fundamental description that corresponds to that operational level of description. And likewise here, the set of scalars you choose is just contingent on the way you're looking at the world. So you choose some set of scalars that's going to correspond to the stuff you measure. Okay. And in particular, what we're interested in is these scalars taking values in coincidence with one another. Okay, so here's a set of scalars. These could be, for example, the densities of the chemical elements. Then we can plot a space like so. Then each point in this space will correspond to a possible observation where this set of scalars have a certain value in coincidence. If you take a solution like the one I just wrote down, and then you look at each point p, then you can calculate the scalars from these tensor fields, and then you'll plot a point in this space here. So if you do that for every point p in the manifold, you'll end up getting a surface in this operational space. That surface will have a dimension which is no greater than the dimension of your manifold, so four-dimensional or less. We can have degeneracy, so it could be that more than one point p will map to the same point in this operational space. And that's fine. That just means that different points in your solution fail to get distinguished operationally. The important point about this surface is that it doesn't move under diffeomorphisms. So if I apply a diffeomorphism to this solution, then these scalar coincidences don't change, because we get the same surface gamma. So this sort of idea, there's a paper by Hans Westman, who was a postdoc here at Perimeter. This is why his name is in blue. And he talked about this approach to understanding general relativity. He wasn't interested in formulating an operational theory, but the mathematical ideas in here are the same. So since this surface doesn't move under diffeomorphisms, it constitutes a good sort of operational space. And then the idea is that this is the right space in which to do operational general relativity. It isn't the only possible choice you might have made. You might try to think of other ways of defining your operational space. But it is at least a choice that we can make. And then once we've made this choice, we can push forward. Are there any questions on this? Is it clear?
Yeah.
Do you have any sense of what a sort of canonical or tomographically complete set of axes would be in this space?
What do you mean by tomographically complete?
Well, I mean, presumably, you've said these S's could be like densities of elements. Presumably, there's a whole long list of observable properties.
So what is true is that no matter how many scalars you have, you may still fail to break this degeneracy I talked about. There can be physical situations where you have symmetry, for example, where no matter how many scalars you have, you fail to have a one-to-one mapping between the manifold and this operational space. So one example of that would be a vacuum solution where the metric is the same everywhere. There's no matter. Then you just get a single point in this space, no matter how many scalars you gave yourself. Or another example would be an expanding spherically symmetric expanding universe. Then rather than having a four-dimensional surface here, you just have a one-dimensional surface because of the spherical symmetry. There's one more question here.
I was just wondering why the number of these scalars seems to stop at some point.
Because these are operationally, it's contingent on the way you look at the world. So whatever sort of experiments you might imagine doing, there's going to be some limited number of properties you're looking at. And so you don't need that many. Of course, but this is a slightly different way of thinking about physics, because it's not a fundamental way of thinking about physics. We're asking, given a certain way of looking at the world operationally, how can we formulate it? But the argument is that quantum theory, if it's properly understood, is actually formulated in that way already. And so this is just bringing the same point of view to bear on general relativity. In some ways, you could think of it like this, that you've got these two theories, quantum theory, which has got all these problems, it's kind of ill understood, and then you've got general relativity as conceived by Einstein, which is this beautiful, elegant theory. And I'm trying to make general relativity worse, trying to sully it and bring it down to the level of quantum theory so that there's some chance of them having a happy marriage. You might hope that in the long run, general relativity will bring out the best in quantum theory and that we can solve some of their problems. But that's the basic idea.
So just following up on that question, I guess what I was trying to ask is there a sense in which you can make a stronger statement, like if I've chosen a particular set of S to SK, can that be sufficient to predict the values of any other observable quantities that you might have also chosen as an axis?
Might have also chosen as scalars. Okay. You're asking if there's some finite set that's always going to be sufficient for any infinite set. I think if you restrict yourself to just vacuum, where you have just the metric and its derivatives to form scalars out of, then I think the answer to that question is yes. And I think there's a set of someone else in the room might know more than me, but there's the Newton-Cartan scalars, which are, I think, sufficient in that respect. In the general case, I don't know if there's an answer to that.
Following up on that question, do we put, for example, one more scalar for each field of the standard model?
But it depends, because this is operational. So it's, if you're an experimentalist and you go into, you start doing an experiment, you're going to read off numbers from various places. So you need enough scalars to cover those numbers that you're reading. But there's also stuff going on behind the scenes, which I'm going to come to, which you're not treating at this operational level. You still need to treat that at in terms of the fields that are there. But maybe I should carry on, and then perhaps this will become.
Can I ask?
I'm a bit worried now about time, so maybe I should carry on and see how far I can get. It was my fault for asking for questions. Okay. So what you can do in this space is you can define regions. So here's a sort of cuboid region. The reason that it's this shape is because I couldn't draw in ticks an arbitrary shaped region. But you could imagine you had some arbitrary shaped region in this space. And so you have this surface gamma. And this intersects this region here in gamma sub A. So the sort of thing you see in this region is gamma sub A. and I want to identify, I want to associate operations in the sense I was talking about earlier, these boxes, with these regions. Okay, so imagine we have a certain region A in this operational space. And now what you can do is you can look at the solution and restrict to that part of the solution whose points get mapped into that region of operational space. Okay. So this is psi tilde sub A. And the manifold, we're only considering the points of the manifold that get mapped into that region, in this region A. So this is the bit of the solution that lives inside A. And this will have all sorts of different fields, whatever fields you have in your standard model and so on. They're all in there. Of course, this is classical physics, but whatever fields you have are all in here. Now, the problem with this object is that it's not diffeomorphism invariant. We can instead construct this object where we take take diffeomorphisms of these objects, so we apply diffeomorphisms, and we apply all possible diffeomorphisms on this object to form a set of all these diffeomorphism transformed objects. And this set now is, in fact, diffeomorphism invariant. I mean, it's a very heavy-handed thing to do, but it's a useful object to have. So this, I've removed the tilde, you'll see, is a diffeomorphism invariant description of the situation inside region A. You could say that this describes the actual situation, the beables in this region. We can also form propositions. So we could say, what's the proposition that the actual situation inside this region is described by psi sub A? So that's a proposition. What about if we want to join two regions? Because remember, if we're doing operationalism, we want to join these regions. Well, we can have two regions. See, these two regions share a surface. Call that surface A. So that's where they're being joined. We can think about joining them. So if we want to join the solutions, the natural way of doing that is defined by this double cup operation. So we have psi A, which is a list of all the diffeomorphisms of solutions that are sort of physically equivalent in region A, likewise in B. What we can do is we can go through those psi tildes in each of those sets pairwise and see if they satisfy appropriate boundary conditions. Okay. So we have this set of all possible diffeomorphisms on these solutions in region A, and likewise in region B. We check and see if the boundary conditions are met. And if the conditions are met, then we form the union, and we keep them. And if they're not met, then we throw them away. So we have the property now that if psi A is a solution to the various field equations for region A, and psi B is a solution for region B, then this double cup union is a solution for A union B. There's a few strange things that can happen. It could be that none of these actually match, in which case what you have is the empty set. But the way I set things up, the empty set is a solution, just trivially, satisfies all the field equations. Every element of the empty set satisfies the field equations. Another thing that can happen is that it can be mixed, and I'll explain what I mean by that on this slide. So you can invent a notion of a pure solution. So this is the notion I've already explained to you. A pure solution psi sub A, is one where all the elements belong to the same equivalence class. Okay, so every element in this actually belongs to the same equivalence class. So there are diffeomorphisms between them. But there's a more general notion, a mixed solution. This is one that's not pure, and it can have more than one equivalence class represented. So you can get a mixed solution if you take the union of distinct solutions. So for example, if you have two pure solutions and you take the union of those, then you'll have more than one equivalence class represented in the list. Okay, and that's turns out to be a natural notion that crops up in this way of thinking. Now, you get this curious property of non-separability. So there are situations where both psi A and psi B are pure, but psi A double cup psi B is mixed. So that's something that can happen. What it means is that complete knowledge about each of the subregions doesn't necessarily give us knowledge about the composite region. So this is a curious property that you can find in this operational way of thinking about general relativity. Okay, so how do we set up operations? We want to set up operations just like we have in quantum theory. Well, the outcome is specified by giving one of these gamma A sets. We have some region A. We can talk about what's observed inside that region, and that's the gamma A set. We identify that with an object like this. This is an operation with an outcome specified. We can also give knob settings in this framework, but I haven't got time to talk about that in this talk. But if you come to the course, I'll talk about that. You know, typically in general relativity, you imagine that you set up some situation at the beginning of the time and then you evolve it forward. But it may be that there are decisions that are made during the evolution of the state of the solution that affect what happens subsequently. And these would be knob settings, and it's possible to put those in. These arrows here just indicate an arbitrary choice of direction in operational space. So if the arrow is pointing towards a symbol, that means you've chosen a direction which is towards the enclosed volume. If they're pointing away, you've chosen an arrow which is pointing away. So they're really just arbitrary choices. They have nothing to do with the flow of time. And now you can write down a proposition that corresponds to this operation. So this proposition would be given by psi of gamma. So this is a list of all the solutions, psi tilde sub A, that are consistent with the outcome that you specified. And this may be mixed. This could contain more than one equivalence class. Okay. So the proposition then that you're making is that the real situation is described by one of the purest solutions that would give rise to this mixed solution. Okay. You can try to join multiple solutions. You can join multiple operations together, sorry. So here what you do is you wire together multiple operations. So I showed you already a situation where you had just two boxes that were adjacent, but you could have a whole bunch of these boxes that are wired together. And anytime that the boxes touch, you have a wire connecting them. And this symbol here just indicates the surface where they overlap, also equipped with a direction. So that's why you have an arrow. In each of these boxes, you have an outcome. That's the gamma set associated with that region. Okay, so what you see in operational space in that region. Okay, and you can ask the possibilistic question, are all the outcomes that you specified jointly possible? Just like I talked about earlier. Okay, well, so that's the kind of the question posed in this operational formulation this possibilistic operational formulation of general relativity. How would we actually do the calculation?
Lucian, can I ask a question here?
Yeah.
So here you said you get these arrows if the boxes touch.
That's right, yeah.
And so you can only see if the boxes touch if you actually have specifically the number of your fields you consider and know that this is a complete.
Sorry, when I say boxes touch, I mean just the boxes as defined in operational space.
Yeah.
So the A, region A.
And then you need to know exactly what is operational.
Yeah, you need to say, yeah, what your set of scalars are. Absolutely,
the
yes. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
If you
yeah.
miss one, then.
No, but you don't, but it's more about.
Asking about is a. Yeah. It's related to locality. It's basically a question what locality means in operational space and maybe real space, and that's an important question.
I mean, it's true that you could go back and do your calculation with more scalar fields if you suddenly, if you realized there was some new set of things you could measure.
These two boxes, if you add scalar fields,
oh yeah, absolutely. They could become more separate. Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
More separate.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of something that you might average over or something, but
Yeah, two boxes. Yeah, absolutely. But I think that's fine. It's just like in the laboratory, you know, in a quantum experiment, you know, maybe you.
So you could still connect them by hours or something.
I mean, a diagram like this is where you have some given set of scalar fields, and then you're describing a given operational situation. You fix the number of because you're fixing the way in which you describe your experiment. Just like you do the same thing in quantum theory, uh-huh. And quantum theory works perfectly well because. All the stuff that you haven't described in this case is still in the fields there. It's not as if you've lost the information, but it wouldn't be in the scalar field. Now, if you later realized you had some extra information in a scalar field, then you could do your calculation again. But just like in quantum theory, you know, you can move the Heisenberg cut. You can say, well, I'm going to put the cut between myself and the and the apparatus, or you can move where you decide to make the partition between classical and quantum. Quantum theory is a similar sort of thing. I think the locality issue is fine because you still have all the information in this size. And that's part of what you use to do the calculation. Okay, so the question is, we have some situation described operationally, and we want to do a calculation as to whether it's possible or not. And you can imagine all sorts of situations. Some of them will be possible, some of them won't. So to do a calculation, you start off with this circuit, and then you have to replace. So I won't have time, of course, to explain what all these things mean exactly. But you start by replacing the operations with the corresponding propositions. And then you can replace these propositions by just the part of the propositions that live at the boundary. You don't really need to know what lives at the interior. You only need to check boundary conditions. So I have what I call boundary propositions. And then you can replace this by these, I call them operational generalized states. These things are equal to, these have labels on them, and they're equal to 0 or 1, depending on whether the boundary condition, whether this boundary proposition has a value for these boundary conditions or not. So this is a way of making a progression of steps. So when you do a calculation, you start off with some operationally described situation. Now you convert it into a proposition. This is a proposition about what's happening underneath. Then you just look at the boundary parts of that proposition. And then finally, you convert to these duotensors that contain this boundary information. The answer at the end will be equal to 0 or 1. So that's the formulation. You can set it up in such a way that this whole thing is manifestly invariant under different morphisms, because all the objects in this formulation are defined in terms of scalars. Defined in terms of scalars that you observe. Okay. So what about quantum gravity? Well, the idea is you want to go from the sort of classical space. Your classical probabilistic theories have some set of possible distinguishable states with a probability distribution over them. Whereas in quantum theory, you have typically a bigger space because you have these off-diagonal components. So you can think about that process as going from a classical space to a quantum-sized space, which has these off-diagonal elements. And then you can use this operator tensor framework I mentioned previously. And then we need to impose what I call physicality conditions. So these are physicality conditions. So in standard quantum theory, we can have conditions on the operators which are such that they guarantee that probabilities are between 0 and 1, and that you cannot signal backwards in time. You can't signal outside the forward light cone. In standard operator tensor quantum theory, there's a very simple way of writing down these physicality conditions. This condition determines the space of allowed operators in quantum theory. So if you know how to write down the physicality condition, then you know everything you need to know, all the space of allowed operators. You can also set up the problem of physicality conditions in operator tensor quantum field theory. These conditions have to look at the metric because they need to know, where the light cone is so as not to signal back in time. So the strategy in quantum gravity is, if you think about it in terms of this analogy. So in special relativity, we have that the metric everywhere is just equal to the Minkowski metric. As we go to general relativity, we now have a dynamical equation. In quantum theory, quantum field theory, we have some physicality condition where you have a fixed metric everywhere, with the Minkowski metric. And that guarantees that all your probabilities are between 0 and 1, and you can't signal backwards in time. What we're missing is a physicality condition for quantum gravity. So this might be somehow analogous to this. And I have no idea how to set that up at this stage. There's lots of things I didn't discuss. I didn't discuss agency, how to include knob settings in this picture. I didn't discuss how to set up the boundary conditions. This is quite subtle. You have to be careful there. What else? So the boundary, you can write down these boundary conditions so that the whole formulation is manifestly invariant under diffeomorphisms. And also, I didn't discuss the probabilistic formulation. I just gave you the possibilistic formulation of general relativity. But if you think about it, there's this fundamental human right to be ignorant. And furthermore, there's a right even to be probabilistically ignorant. And if you're probabilistically ignorant, then even if you have a deterministic theory, you may not have all the information, and so you may want to use a probabilistic formulation of it. So in the paper, I show how to set up a probabilistic formulation. It looks very similar to the possibilistic formulation I gave you already. So, conclusions. In order to do this, we need to use this operational space, and this is meant to be the place where our observations live. You could investigate different choices of operational space, and perhaps you could still formulate an operational version of general relativity. And then if we do that, we can get an operational formulation of GR, just like quantum theory. And that's good because I think the only agreed upon formulation of quantum theory is the operational one. There's not really a sort of ontological interpretation of quantum theory that's agreed upon by everybody. The formulation is manifestly invariant under diffeomorphisms. We could try to use this operational approach to GR to solve various problems. It might be interesting to look at black hole singularities. The reality of gravitational waves is something people work on that might benefit from this kind of operational approach. It's even possible that numerical simulations in this operational approach could be better, although at this stage I don't see how.
What do you mean by reality of gravitational waves?
There's all this debate. You know, Yeah, sure, but theoretical reality. You know, like there's all this debate. You know, whether the gravitational waves are real or not, and you know, people like Einstein doubted it at some point. And
real in what sense?
Whether you can transform them by diffeomorphisms, whether they carry energy, this kind of question. But Beatrice Bonga, who's a postdoc here, works on that kind of thing. But sure, they've been detected. the main motivation here was to open up a route to a theory of quantum gravity. And finally, there's this question of the interpretational issues of quantum theory. You know, quantum theory is something that we don't really understand. One hope I have is that if we find an appropriate theory of quantum gravity, then suddenly everything will become crystal clear. We'll understand what the hell was going on. Thanks.
usual, I'd like to start with questions. Any questions from the students?
Yeah, so I was wondering if there's a clear way, or let's say prescription, to decide which scalars are good to build operational space.
Right.
Because let's say that we think about, okay, the density of some fluid, I'm, you know, like floating around. But I could say, okay, the density of the fluid here or over there. But I also have to mean what, I have to prescribe what I mean with over there.
Yeah, that, yeah.
I also have to determine
yeah.
what that means. So
yeah.
in that sense, how do we decide which scalars are
yeah.
Alone by themselves and which are like kind of like composite ones? First saying what I mean over there and then the density.
Is there any way you might have to actually set up what you mean by operationally, what you mean by over here, over there, is with respect to yet some more stuff.
Yeah.
Which you could describe by scalars, like, you know, like maybe you set up a reference frame with wood.
Okay.
And you put marks on the piece of wood to say where you are, and you somehow establish your relationship. Well, that all that's a physical thing that you would do. And in this point of view, you would be reading off the values of scalars in coincidence that would determine where you were in that reference frame. Einstein talked about a reference mollusk, so some substance permeating, you know, space-time that you would use to read off your location. In one sense, what's being done here is you know, you have all these scalars, and you could say, well, we could use some of them to read off our position in space-time, and others to look at, you know, local properties. But we're treating all the scalars on the same footing, so it's a sort of democracy between scalars.
Okay.
And so then it's not really important as to, you know, where you are is just where you are in this operational space. There's,
right.
there's no more meaning to the question than that. There's a question. Tika? So you could find yourself in a certain, you know, like we're in this room, for example, and this room is defined, you know, this room plus all the things we imagine might happen in this room is defined by some region of operational space, all the various coincidences that we could imagine might happen in this room. So that would be a region of operational space. But then there's different things that might happen in this room. Like, you know, I might or might not let go of this piece of chalk. And those will correspond to different gamma surfaces. You know, different things that might happen would correspond to different gamma surfaces within that region. So they really are like the light flashing red or green or blue. They're different things that could happen in a region of operational space would correspond to different gamma A sets. So you can do just classical probabilistic framework where you have ignorance and then you have to introduce distributions over these beer balls in the appropriate way. You could also think about quantum gravity, and if you do that you would want to enlarge your space so that you have Hilbert space rather than just you know, the distinguishable classical situations, and proceed from there. So then you would have something like superpositions.
Trying to think about whether the set of scalars that you are choosing, whether they would be enough or not. So I'm thinking of the case in which, well, I assume, first of all, when you say scalars, you mean gauge invariants.
Yeah.
Right. So you are hoping that there is a subset of gauge invariant quantities in terms of which you will be able to formulate quantum gravity. Now, on the other hand, with what we are already familiar in quantum field theory, which would include quantized general relativity, there are also off-shell quantities that are very useful in doing computations that are, by being off-shell, they are not gauge invariant. So I'm wondering whether you would be able to somehow be able to also include the types of computations that you need to do that we are already familiar, which do involve gauge non-invariant in your formulation.
So, I mean, so the thing I presented was just classical general relativity.
But I assume you are taking...
But of course, yeah, of course one wants to go to the quantum case. But then... So from the operational point of view, any outcomes you have would have to be described in a gauge invariant fashion because they're just outcomes. The outcome happens, the red light flashes or the blue light flashes. So at that level of description, everything is naturally invariant.
The outcome is always gauge invariant.
Yeah. So that's
external legs, if you like, of any computation, they are R-shaped.
Right.
But the intermediate legs are off-shelf, and so
then,
just cut your diagram anywhere.
So then there's a question of how you calculate the probabilities for those outcomes that you see.
Yeah. Well,
and a question, can you calculate those probabilities in terms of, you know, calculation where the objects inside there are also gauge invariant? In these operational formulations just of quantum theory, it's so simple quantum theory, finite dimensional Hilbert spaces and so on. I think the answer is yes, but whether...
The question would be also a valid question without general relativity, just ordinary quantum field theory, where you also have, let's say, gauge theory, QCD or something like that, which you also, in any computation, in most computation, you would have intermediate stages where you are dealing, having to deal with gauge non-invariants.
Right. In some sense, this project is so far away from some of those questions that it's difficult. You know, if I eventually get to that stage, I'll have a better perspective on them. But it's
The formulation from the beginning, because you want to be only
with the gauge invariants. Right. I mean, as it stands, it works. But whether you can address those questions, you have to get there before I can tell you. Yeah.
Maybe I can comment further because. What you describe as operational space is maybe relational observables, and you try to compute this actually. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's they are hard to compute because to get them, I mean, what you already deal with in your formulation is a space of solutions. Mm-hmm. So to do anything explicitly, you need to solve the equations of motions, which is not very simple for general relativity. And that's maybe part of the difficulty. And what people usually do or sometimes do is some kind of deparametrization where you basically are in a region where you can map your operational space very nicely to some piece of four-dimensional manifold, which, however, doesn't go very well with quantum theory where you need to know lots of these global properties of your operational space. Or the properties of the solutions.
I mean, there's a different perspective.
It's a nice framework, having control over these gamma surfaces, each of your gamma surfaces, is of course a solution. So you work directly with the space of solutions.
Right.
And the problem is to get control over the space of solutions.
So in operational quantum theory, there's a slightly different perspective. You know, you might say, well, in quantum theory, we need to solve the Hamiltonian. We have some detailed Hamiltonian. We have to solve it and work out, you know, which wave functions are solutions and so on. It's the same kinds of issues. But in operational quantum theory, what you do is you impose conditions on allowed operators. And these conditions, the physicality conditions I talked about, in more common language, they would be that they have to be trace non-increasing completely positive maps. And then those conditions give you a space of allowed operations. And you can physically realize any of those operations. So from the operational point of view, of course, the Hamiltonians that you use underneath to realize those different operations may be different, but you can realize any of them. And so the hope here is that if you can just prescribe, if you can give very general constraints on what the allowed set of these generalized states are associated with operations, from some very general reasons of that sort, then you could have the same approach to operational quantum theory.
Yeah, I'm a bit, I mean, I think if I speak of calculation, then the main, I think the main problem is to associate it or to find a given amplitude to process. That's what I would.
Right, well, here it's different. The main thing is to find the probability. There's no.
Yeah. From that, the probability. So for me.
Right, okay.
Given some boundary conditions, which indeed you can also set up in an operational space.
Mm-hmm.
But then, again, the main difficulty of putting yourself in operational space.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's some people tried that, including myself.
Right.
So there are certain practical difficulties in that if you really try to run explicit calculations which have something to do with locality and so on. And as you say, maybe in your framework, it is really to what you call physicality, which again in quantum gravity means something very specific.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it means actually solving the dynamics of your theory.
Right.
Because it means specifying all possible
mm-hmm.
solutions,
mm-hmm.
which means solving your theory.
Right.
In this case, physicality means determining all possible.
Right.
Determining all possible surfaces in your virtual space.
Mm-hmm.
And this question about time ordering or, you know, putting causality, I think that's a very open question.
Right. Yeah.
It's basically an open question what that has to do with physicality.
Mm-hmm.
In your operational space, there's no a priori no time, which I like, so.
Right. Yeah.
So you can formulate all the questions which you had here without referring to time ever.
Right.
And it only comes through the interpretation at some point. So that's a feature of basically the relational framework.
Right. Yeah. I agree that as it's formulated, you need to know in order to pin down what the allowed operations are, or what the allowed propositions are. Let's say. You need to know the solutions. But the hope is, like I say, that there are these very general constraints in the context of operational quantum theory that give you the space of allowed solutions in quite a nice way. And there's a different sort of attitude to setting up the theory.
So I have a question. Have you given any thought to how you would formulate strong equivalence principle in this framework? Because the normal way to think about it is that I have, you know, a vessel that's essentially shielded from exterior influences,
mm-hmm.
and it's, you know, in two different relative situations to its
right.
environment, accelerating through free space or
yeah.
in a uniform gravitational field, then from within that vessel, all observational phenomena look the same.
Mm-hmm.
So in your framework, that'll mean you're at the same point in the observational space.
Right.
So how do I articulate the content of the strong equivalence principle in this operational space? It seems like a kind of natural fit to your framework, and I'm just unclear on how you would express it.
Yeah, it's a good question. In some sense, the function of the strong equivalence principle in general relativity is with respect to the field equations and you know what certain properties they have, and so that gets buried inside the detail of how you choose this, how you determine these solutions in this current framework.
Maybe it's a composition principle.
Yeah, maybe. Seems like something different.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer. Maybe that would do. But I have an answer to a slightly different question, which I like, which is I earlier gave this analogy between the. Maybe this relates to what Bianca was just saying. There's this composition principle, this generalized still composition and the equivalence. Sorry, principle general compositionality and the principle general covariance are set up sort of analogous to one another. And then you might ask, in this analogy, what is the analog of the equivalence principle? Something that would play the same kind of role. I imagine that the fact that there exists a set of distinguishable situations, each of which has definite causal structure, would be the analogy. So, even in the case of quantum theory, you know, your quantum situation would be a superposition of situations which had definite causal structure. your basis, if you like, would be would be a set of situations that had definite causal structure. But it's just that's just an analogy. I'm not sure about the actual question you asked.
So your lecture series starts next.
It starts on Monday.
Okay. All right, let's thank you again.
Thank you.